Pediatrician is a podcast of the Alabama chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, designed to bring the latest news and updates in child health to pediatricians across Alabama. We'll be covering a range of topics from advocacy and practice management to mental health and injury prevention and everything in between. So whether you're a pediatrician in Birmingham or Mobile, in Pine Level or Slapout, this podcast is for you.
Welcome back to the Alabama Pediatrician Podcast. I'm your host today, Dr. John McClendon, the Area 6 representative of the Alabama chapter of the AAP. April is National Childhood Abuse Prevention Month, and joining us today to talk about this is Elizabeth Shapley, the nurse practitioner at UAB and Children's in the Department of Childhood Abuse. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm honored to get to join you today.
If you don't mind, could you just kind of give us a brief overview of what you do at Children's and how long you've been doing it?
Sure. So I have been in this role for almost 2 years now, and I have the honor of evaluating children who come to Children's of Alabama and there is concern for an inflicted injury. So they will consult our team, which is the Child Abuse Division, and we will go evaluate those children and give our evaluation. I also see kids in the outpatient setting through the CHIP Center. The CHIP Center sees kids for follow-up if they were seen in the hospital and there was concern for inflicted injury and we want to reevaluate the kids. We also see non-acute sexual assault survivors in the CHIP Center. The CHIP Center does a lot with child abuse prevention, and they also offer counseling services free of charge to the survivor and their non-offending caregiver as well.
Personally, I've had some experience with this working with Dr. Bernard and Dr. Peters in the past. In my experience, I've learned that a lot of this is medicine and a lot of this is legal issues. And sometimes we are not very well trained as pediatricians in dealing with the legal aspect of it. So I figure we could start off with that and just talking briefly about the types of abuse and the legal definitions of those abuse. And so if you might could kind of give us a background on that.
Sure. So the legal definition of a child is any person under 18 years of age. The legal definition of child abuse is the harm or threatened harm to a child's health or welfare. This can occur through non-accidental physical or mental injury, sexual abuse or attempted sexual abuse, or sexual exploitation or attempted sexual exploitation.
I know there are different types of abuse, especially from a legal perspective. Can you go over some of those?
Absolutely. So the types of child maltreatment that we mainly look at is, of course, abuse. So physical abuse, physical neglect, psychological maltreatment, and then sexual abuse. Really, there's not a lot of litigation or trying offenders right now when it comes to the psychological maltreatment, but I believe in our generation and continuing on, we will begin seeing more of that.
We were talking earlier about going over kind of an overview of the situation in Alabama, and I know you have some statistics about the reporting in Alabama and how they compare nationally. So could you kind of fill us in on what the situation is currently in our state?
Absolutely. So it's interesting whenever we look at this compared to the national average. So in the state of Alabama, and these statistics are from the National Child Abuse and Neglect Data System, Child Maltreatment of 2022. This is our most recent data that we have. So overall, the total population of children nationally is almost 73 million. In Alabama, the total population of children is just over 1 million. If we're looking at the number of reports of abuse in Alabama, it's almost 27,000 reports of abuse, which is really incredible when you think about it.
And that's per year?
This is from just the year of 2022.
Just the year 22. Okay.
Correct. And this would involve 39,500 children. So these were all reports, and it was determined that these were substantiated or indicated in almost 30% of the cases that were reported. This involved 538 caseworkers. So we can imagine the burden or the influx that our state is experiencing because of this. If we go down specifically and think about the categories and the types of abuse that our state is facing compared to nationally, it's interesting as well. So in nationally, neglect makes up about 75% of types of abuse. In Alabama, it's a lot lower at 41%. But let's not toot our horn too much, because when we look down at physical abuse, Alabama is 53% physical abuse, whereas the national average is 17%. So it is significantly more than the national average when we look at physical abuse in the state of Alabama.
Wow, that's interesting and concerning, to be honest.
Sure, it absolutely is. We are also above the national average in sexual abuse as well. So the state of Alabama is 17% sexual abuse, whereas the national average is just over 10%.
So now that we kind of have a better indication of the numbers nationally in Alabama, do you have any other general statistics that would be informative?
Sure. I think it's important to note that it's estimated that about 10% of all injuries to children less than 5 years old seen in the emergency department are due to child abuse. 89% of these cases involve at least one parent as the perpetrator, with only about 4% being unmarried partners of a parent, and then about 6% were other relatives of the victim. I think that mom's boyfriend oftentimes gets a really bad rap. But whenever we look at that statistic, we know that that's not necessarily completely true, that more often than not, it's the parent as the main perpetrator.
I do remember being taught that if mom has a boyfriend, that's almost an immediate red flag. But statistically, that may not be completely accurate, and we definitely don't need to jump to conclusions.
Sure, absolutely. And I'll be honest, whenever I hear I'm talking to a parent and I hear about a boyfriend at home, immediately my red flag still goes up, because I think that's our nature and that's kind of been ingrained.
Right.
But I think statistically, it behooves us to realize that there's more than one person that it could be. I think something that's also interesting is that death due to child abuse is more common than childhood deaths due to meningitis, leukemia, and HIV/AIDS.
Wow.
And so we see a huge push in these areas for prevention and education. But, you know, are we seeing a huge push of this, of child abuse prevention, right? When we know that death to child abuse is more common than those things, I think it's interesting to think about.
Sure.
So, yes, the leading cause of death, though, is neglect, and then followed by physical abuse.
A kid that's under five that comes in with injury is so common, and to think that one out of every 10 of those is going to be from abuse, it really does make you more aware of that as a possibility. That is definitely not insignificant in the least.
Absolutely.
So speaking of that, can you go over some of the common presentations that we should be looking for as pediatricians that should bring up some red flags?
Absolutely. So cutaneous injuries are going to be your most common presentation of physical abuse. When I say cutaneous injuries, I'm talking about abrasions, bruises, lacerations, burns. So if we kind of break that down a little bit more, we can kind of parse through these things. So in bruises, something that is helpful to think through is the mnemonic 10-4, facies P. So we're going to break down 10-4 first. The T stands for torso, and that's going to include the chest, abdomen, back, genitals, or buttocks. So bruises in those areas. And then the E stands for ears. N stands for neck.
Okay.
And then 4 is under the age of 4. So if you have bruises to those areas under the age of 4, it is concerning.
Torso, neck, ears, and less than 4. Okay.
Correct. Or any bruising anywhere on the body under 4 months of age. It's concerning.
Okay.
So that 4 stands for 2 different things. And then if we break down the next mnemonic, facies, P, that's going to include F being the frenulum. And of course, there are 3 that we're going to be looking at and evaluating. That's the upper and lower lip, and the tongue. Angle of the jaw, so any bruising at the angle of the jaw. Any bruising at the cheek. The C stands for cheek. And then bruising to the eyelids, which is the E. And then any scleral hemorrhaging. The S stands for scleral hemorrhaging. And then P is going to be pattern bruises.
I do think that being familiar with that mnemonic could potentially help pick up on some cases of abuse that might otherwise be missed. For example, I often think about bruising on the ears and the torso, but don't always remember to look at the frenulum.
Absolutely. Yes, I think so too. It surprises me how often I do see tears to the frenulum. I think kind of going into this, it's one of those things that you don't really imagine happening often, but I see it more than I thought I would.
So the mechanism for the frenulum tears, kind of what were we looking for and why would that be?
The mechanism for the way that the frenulum would tear is if an infant's crying, oftentimes their tongue goes to the roof of their mouth. And then a frustrated caregiver may be attempting to shove something into their mouth, which causes that sublingual frenulum to tear, whether they're trying to shove a bottle in the mouth or a finger, something like that to make them be quiet. That's the way in which the frenulum would tear. And so same reason why the upper and lower lip frenulums would also tear is forceful objects going into the mouth.
So other than the mnemonics on what bruises to look for, what other advice do you have about bruising on children that should be always kept in mind?
Sure. So we talked a little bit about pattern bruises. I think that making sure that you're looking for any type of unusual patterns that may be on the child's body that may look like strap marks or handprints or bite marks, things like that, making sure that you're making note of those things. Another thing that is helpful to consider is this phrase, no bruising until cruising. So if a child is not able to move to get around on their own, there should be no bruising. And then I think another thing that's helpful to remember is that we cannot scientifically reliably date injuries by the color of the bruises. Oftentimes I'll see documentation where it says bruises in different stages of healing. And that's something that really needs to come out of our charting.
So you're saying that not only can you not give a specific age for a bruise, you also can't compare the age of two different bruises on the body that may even look different. Is that correct?
Yes. So, we can't really say old versus new. Everyone looks different. They actually polled, I'll have to find that study and send it to you, but they polled, I don't know how many physicians and asked them to date bruises, and it was completely across the board. So there's no science behind it.
Interesting.
Definitely. So this idea of being able to chart or document bruises in different stages of healing really needs to be thrown out of our mindset.
So when you're documenting bruises, just where they are, what the size of them are, how many there are, that's important. But like, I learned this when I was kind of doing this as well, is that when you start to presume things, that can be not very good from a legal standpoint.
Exactly. Yeah, you're right about that. Whenever you are looking at bruises and there's a lot or there's concern for it, some lab workup that needs to be done to make sure that we're not missing anything else underlying that would be causing this child to bruise more easily is the following. So it's going to be a CBC with a platelet count. PT, PTT, INR.
Okay.
A von Willebrand factor panel and the factor 9 deficiency level.
Okay.
So inevitably, this can come up on the back end with litigation. The conversation of, well, does this child have a bleeding disorder or an inability to clot correctly that would cause them to bruise like this? And so we want to be able to definitively say, we looked into that. And these are the lab results. Therefore, no, this child does not have a clotting disorder and an inability to clot correctly that would cause them to bruise excessively.
And I will, to the people listening on the podcast, I will put the mnemonic and a list of those labs in the podcast description so that you will have those. So if you do happen to be driving at the moment, don't try to write that down. We'll put that in there for you. What about bites and burns? When do we need to be concerned about those?
Sure. So a helpful tip whenever you are evaluating bite is to grab a handy dandy ruler and measure your distance. So we're going to look at the canine to canine distance.
Okay.
An adult dental arch size is going to be between 3 and 4.5 centimeters. Whereas a child is going to be less than 3. So if you're wondering, is this a child bite or is this an adult bite? Grabbing the ruler and measuring the distance can help you determine that. So do that measurement and then also make sure that you're taking great, good photographs. Do photograph documentation. And that's the case with bruises as well.
Okay.
So whenever you're doing your photograph documentation, pull away, take a shot away from the location that you're going to take the photograph. And then move in closer so that we can see the actual bruise or the actual bite up close. And that just helps us kind of orient to the place on the body in which we are viewing the image.
Okay.
Of course, in your documentation, you're gonna give specifics of the point of the locations in which you're seeing these injuries.
Right.
A little bit about burns. So just a couple of comments. So most abusive burns are because of an immersion into hot tap water. Sometimes it can be just, hey, I didn't check the water before I put the kiddo in there. And unfortunately, it was way too hot. And now this child has a burn. Forced immersion burns will give kind of a donut type shape, and it will spare parts of the buttocks in the back. So oftentimes you are escalating care when you're looking at burns, but if you don't have a great history for what happened as far as, you know, a splatter burn or a spill or things like that, it's worth paying more attention to and kind of considering more in depth.
So we were talking about the injuries, especially in children under 5, being concerning, 10% possibly being from abuse. So I'm sure a lot of those are fractures. So can you go over the common fractures that should bring up red flags?
Absolutely. Some things that you can think through whenever you are considering fractures and trying to determine if they are inflicted versus accidental is considering if there are fractures in multiple different sites. Another thing you can think through is if there are fractures that are in different stages of healing, or if the history that you are receiving does not match the injury that you're looking at. Also, consider the location of the fracture. So if we think through some high specificity of abuse, the locations for those types of fractures are, of course, posterior rib fractures. A lot of us know about that. Metaphyseal lesions, scapular fractures, any type of spinous process fractures, and sternal fractures. So those are going to be very high specificity for infant abuse. Moderate specificity are going to be multiple fractures, kind of what we mentioned, fractures in different stages of healing, digital fractures, and then complex skull fractures. And then low specificity, although these are common, they are low specificity for abuse. That's going to be clavicle fractures, long bone shaft fractures, and then linear skull fractures.
Okay.
So I know that was a lot of information, which I'm sure you can put that also in the tips below. But
do you have any that you see most commonly that you're like, this is very concerning? Like, you know, having all those things, a lot to remember, but do you have some that are like, yeah, this is what we see, this is when you should really be worried, like, or the most common one in that situation?
Sure. So the classic metaphyseal lesion, that metaphyseal fracture, we call it classic for a reason. It's classic for abuse, but that's in a child who's under 2 years old. So after 2 years old, their own weight and their own torsion can cause that type of injury. But younger than that, we're highly concerned for an inflicted injury in those cases.
Okay.
That type of fracture occurs from torsion of the bone. And so it usually occurs from being yanked up. If it's on the distal femur, maybe they've been yanked up by the knee or something like that. But it's generally highly specific for physical abuse.
So I guess that kind of brings to the question of when to get skeletal surveys and any advice on those.
Yeah, that's a great question. So in considering skeletal surveys, we're also good. This will also apply to any type of cutaneous injuries as well. But you're going to do a skeletal survey on any and all suspected victims of abuse who are younger than 2 years old.
Okay.
It's going to be selective on children who are 2 to 5 years of age. And by selective, I mean there's high concern for it. And so that's going to be the child that you do the skeletal survey on. It is not recommended 5 years or older.
Okay.
It is not recommended at that age. The child can typically tell you, hey, I have pain in this location. It's just that the percent positive at that point of doing a full skeletal survey isn't helpful.
Good to know. If you're a pediatrician, you're not at Children's or not at South Alabama, and you don't have a pediatric specific radiologist to reading your skeletal survey, can most radiologists still do a pretty good job and pick up on that? Or should you, can you feel pretty good if they say everything looks good? Or is that something, if you still had suspicion, you might want to contact a pediatric radiologist to verify that?
Yes, I think you absolutely could do that. And then the other thing to consider is that if you are still highly, highly concerned, or there is confirmed physical abuse, then considering doing a follow-up limited skeletal survey in about 2 weeks after that first skeletal survey. So oftentimes it's really difficult to see subtle acute fractures on x-rays. And so hopefully once they do that follow-up skeletal survey, then we can pick up fractures that may have been there because they're in their healing state, and that's just easier to see on x-rays than fractures in acute state.
So let's talk a little bit now about another big concern, which is head trauma. If you don't mind just kind of going into that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. So we think about head trauma, some other names for it that I'm sure you all have heard. It's going to be non-accidental head injury, or shaken baby syndrome, or shaken impact syndrome. We've kind of moved away from those names because it doesn't encompass other types of head trauma. So shaken baby doesn't encompass the child who's been slammed against a hard object. And so that's why we've kind of moved towards the term of abusive head trauma. Some things that should be considered whenever you are possibly diagnosing this or thinking about it is an infant who has some unexplained seizures, vomiting when, and then the child is drowsy or lethargic, they don't want to suck a bottle and they're vomiting, consider it then. Of course, subdural hematomas. If there's this apparent failure to thrive or you have other signs of physical abuse. And then also a sudden increase in head circumference. So, you know, I think unfortunately right now, we typically do not get head circumferences on sick visits. And I think that we should reevaluate that decision and consider always getting head circumferences, because that can really clue us in that something is going on if we have a sudden increase in a head circumference. So I think it's a quick measurement to get, but its benefit is huge. So I know usually pediatrics office just get them with well child visits or their monthly checkups. But if we can consider also doing them with sick visits, I think we can catch a lot more of the subtle head traumas. And why it's important is some statistics that I think would kind of give us some insight into this is that 20% of abusive head trauma victims actually die. A lot of those are going to be the ones that are pretty obvious, but that means that 65% of the surviving abusive head trauma children are left with significant disability. And so are there those that we are missing because, you know, the thorough evaluation isn't there? It's possible. And so are there down the road sequelae that we could also have insight into by diagnosing these?
That's great advice on getting ahead to circumference. I've never even thought about that. And we normally only think about it in terms of hydrocephalus or something like that. But if it looks normal, then that helps kind of make you feel a little bit better. But if it's bad, definitely call your attention to it for sure.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Kind of moving on from the physical abuse, we were going to talk a little bit about neglect, which I guess it was kind of interesting to me when you talk about the percentage of national child abuse. 75% is basically neglect. And I think we do kind of look for the signs of physical abuse. We keep that in our mind, but sometimes the neglect, especially the more subtle neglect, we tend to overlook a little bit. I don't know if you might have found that in your experience as well, but if you could just kind of go into the types of neglect so that we can keep that more in our mind.
Sure, absolutely. First of all, I'll kind of just give you the definition of what we consider neglect to be, and that's the failure of caretakers to just provide for the basic needs of their children. And that can be either deliberately, they intended not to do that, or by extraordinary inattentiveness, they neglected the child. Both reasons are what they are, but both are neglect, and they both end up harming the child. So when we consider the types of neglect, I'm going to talk about four major categories, and then I can kind of go into a little bit more details about what I mean by those. But physical neglect, and then supervisional neglect, emotional neglect, and then educational neglect. And so specifically, physical neglect is kind of what we can imagine. So just the basic lack of providing for the child's physical needs, and that could be both medical and dental, actually. And then if we think about supervisional neglect, that's going to be lack of safety for the child, custody and attention, and then abandonment of the child as well. Emotional neglect is going to be the inattention to the child's emotional needs of nurture and affection. And then also that includes mental health care neglect. And then educational neglect is going to include truancy, the failure to enroll a child into school, and then the inattention to special educational needs. I think right now there's a lot of families who will say that they are involved in a homeschool program. And I think a question to ask those folks is, oh, tell me more about the program that you're using. I do feel like parents who use homeschooling programs, they know all about it. And, you know, they can tell you about their schedule and what they're doing. But if someone's unable to kind of give you that information, but they're saying that they are involved in a homeschooling program, then that might raise a red flag, and you might want to consider investigating further.
Are there specific things that you guys get referred to for neglect in that setting, or is that something mostly that is handled by DHR and, you know, the investigation in that standpoint?
Sure. We do get a lot of cases of neglect, actually. I would say oftentimes it's physical neglect who we see. So the kids where there's overt failure to thrive, there's not an underlying medical diagnosis or reason why that child should not be gaining weight, but they enter the hospital, they gain an abundant amount of weight, and then we're concerned at that point that there's been without food at home. Definitely don't see much emotional neglect or educational neglect. Some of our cases we will determine to be supervisional neglect. Oftentimes those can be our burn cases. So there was a failure to check the water prior to putting a child into it. And so that would be considered supervisional neglect, or a child was left in the bathtub and there was a terrible outcome or something like that. That would be considered supervisional neglect as well.
I see. So I guess that kind of brings us to our next topic is, as a pediatrician, our job to report these, because we're often the first people who will recognize this. And I know, having done clinic for a long time and now as a hospitalist myself, there is a little bit of apprehension sometimes about reporting where you think this could possibly be abuse. I don't necessarily think it is, but it is on my differential, and I do have some mild suspicion. And I think sometimes it's easier just to kind of hope that that's not the case. And so I was wondering if you could kind of give us your thoughts on when we really should report it, and not having to feel like we know for sure that this is abuse before we report it. That's kind of not the pediatrician's job to figure that all out. The pediatrician's job is more to make sure we don't miss it. And
exactly. Yes, you were absolutely right about that. As everyone well knows, providers and medical providers are mandated reporters. And so we are required to report suspected child maltreatment. That does not mean verified child maltreatment. That just means suspected. So if you have concern, that needs to be reported. And as you mentioned, you're not saying, I am absolutely 100% certain this is happening, but I'm asking for help in evaluating the situation and ensuring that the child is safe. I think it's better to report than not. We all would hate for a bad outcome to happen because we did not report whenever we had initial concerns. So the way in which we report is by doing that to a duly constituted authority. In our state, that's going to be the Department of Human Resources, DHR, or law enforcement. That needs to be done by a verbal report and then followed by a written report. That written report can just be your clinic note. You do not have to do anything different to give to DHR or law enforcement. Your clinic note that's spelling out and writing out your concerns is appropriate and enough. Something to also consider is that if there is great concern for the child's safety, and you are highly concerned that if that child leaves your office, then there could be immediate risk to the child. A physician who is treating that child can keep him or her in their custody without the consent of a parent or guardian under an Alabama code. And so that's something to keep in mind if there is immediate danger to that child's life or health.
I'm guessing you would call authorities if the parents will not leave, but you don't necessarily have to go through a judge first. You have that ability as a pediatrician to do that until that can be sorted out. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yes.
Okay.
They would have to immediately notify the court who has jurisdiction over the child, but you would keep that child and then call for help, but you do not have to. You are allowed to keep them without releasing them to their caregiver if you have concern of immediate danger.
So like, an extremely angry parent, you've seen abusing the child basically in the clinic, then you are totally within your moral and legal rights to take the child, call the authorities, and then call the judge or the thing and tell them what's going on. So that's good to know.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
I hope I never have that situation, but just in case, it's good to know that. So making that report for suspicion, obviously that can be a very unpleasant conversation to have with families. Do you have any advice on how, as a pediatrician, to do that without causing kind of a loss of a patient or a loss of confidentiality, and not confidentiality, but having loss of a
rapport,
because you want to look out for the child, but also, you know, if there is nothing going on, that could obviously be devastating to the relationship with your patient. So any advice on ways to kind of handle that?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I hear that. I think that especially a lot of you pediatricians who have been in a relationship with these families for many, many, many years, that can be a really hard conversation to have. I think a way that is helpful to approach that conversation is saying, because of X, Y, and Z on their physical exam, or I'm seeing this, and because of that, it has made me concerned that someone is hurting your child. And I think doing it in a way that makes that parent feel like the two of you are on the same team, that neither of you want anybody to be hurting this child. And so because of that, we need help in figuring out what's going on. I think that you can do it in a way that continues to build rapport and to establish a continuance of care for that child, that, you know, almost like you wouldn't want me not to report kind of thing.
Yeah, I've kind of had that conversation with parents and just saying, you know, my obligation is to look out for the best interest of the child. I know that is your desire as well. And so if you look at it from my standpoint, this is something that will help us make sure nothing is bad. And that tends to work fairly well because you're putting an interest on the child rather as a you're being the child's doctor and the child's advocate as opposed to being a confrontational to the parent. It seems to help some too.
Exactly. Absolutely. Because you're not finger pointing, right? Our job as providers is not to be the detective in this and say exactly who did it, or the whodunit part isn't us, right? That's what we see a lot around here. But our job is the medical part. And so
right.
I think if you can build rapport in that sense, it can be helpful.
Yeah. Well, that is very good. I think very practical information in a situation that is probably more common than we even realize and that we should always keep in mind, unfortunately.
You know, unfortunately, child abuse happens all around us. And so I think bringing more awareness to it can be really helpful. And I think even considering, as it is Child Abuse Prevention Month, considering prevention things, educating families on normal childhood development can help their expectations of the child too. While we're talking about the side of, you know, diagnosing and treating, considering prevention as well can be helpful.
Yeah, that's a great point. So in talking about prevention, do you have any specific recommendations on, you know, I know it's mostly education for the parents, but any like very high yield topics that you could instruct the parents on to help with the prevention?
Sure. You know, I think oftentimes if we're thinking about infants who are physically abused, the number one inciting factor is crying. And so almost brainstorming with families, what can we do when your child is just, you're losing it and your child won't stop crying? Something that I like to consider is that a child never gets hurt if they're just laid down. And so if you have a moment where this child won't stop crying, you feel yourself coming to the end of your rope, put the child down and go outside. They will be okay. They will be okay.
I'm not sure if you're familiar with Dr. Harvey Karp, the happiest baby on the block, but he gave me grand rounds when I was at Children's, when I was a resident there. And I teach almost every newborn parent, especially first times, the five S's and consoling the baby and just saying, look, there's going to come a time where you just think you can't handle this. And I do think that is a very beneficial aspect because as somebody who's had two babies and one who cried for most of the first year of his entire life, I can definitely understand how you get to that point, you know, and I had a wonderful wife and all the support in the world and educated and, you know, as a pediatrician, and it was still, it's hard. It's still amazing that it does not happen more than it does. I've always thought because it's tough, especially being sleep deprived and, you know, not taking care of yourself. So I always tell people to get the entire family involved if they can to help with being exhausted, because that does not help anything at all. We usually end each podcast with one brief take-home message. If you had just one thing to kind of emphasize to the pediatricians in Alabama, do you have one that might be beneficial
I was just going to say one is one too many, but I don't know how that helps pediatricians.
Well, it is, and I think that I'm glad, you know, hopefully making it more aware and what to look for and when to report and just having less of anxiety about doing the reports may help some, because I do remember seeing that if you look at the children who have died from abuse, that you may know this statistic, but it's a high percentage of them have been seen for suspicious concerns previously to the incident. And I always hope I never go through that situation where I clearly miss something.
Yes, absolutely. I feel that way as well. I feel like this is a field where the expectation is to bat 1,000, and I have that expectation on myself because the implications are huge both ways. But I think if, you know, we have to just do our best and show up every day trying to do our best.
Yeah, I think so, and take it very seriously. And I think you're right. It is, you know, when I was doing the abuse, when I was in Dothan, we were doing that. And, you know, it is hard because the only thing worse than a child being abused is accusing somebody of doing that they didn't do. And that can be, it was, when I did that for a while, I admire you guys for being able to do this, because that was one of the tougher stretches I've went through seeing some things. So I'm glad that you guys are there, and thank you so very much for doing the job you did. I know it's not an easy one for sure.
Thank you for saying that. It's not easy, but it really is an honor to meet these kids in some of their hardest times, most vulnerable times for sure. And, you know, we get to treat them, but then also on the other side of that, advocate for justice for their alleged perpetrator. And so it doesn't end with the medical evaluation, right? It continues on for potentially years. So.
And I do remember, you know, people asking how you do that. Well, if I do this or not, or we're here or not, that does not change. Just because I don't know about it does not mean it's not happening. So kind of that's the way I always approached it was, you know, I can't just hide in the sand and pretend this doesn't happen, because it does. And the only people that will look out for the children sometimes are the pediatricians. And as we're the ones who are seeing them on a routine basis and knowing them and have the authority to look out for them. So I think that's very important.
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure. I would also like to mention that if there are any questions that come up while people are in practice, there is a child abuse provider on call 24/7, and they can reach out to us with any questions, and we are happy to help. The way that you would get in touch with us is by just calling the children's operator 205-638-9100 and asked to page the child abuse provider on call.
Excellent. That's very helpful. Well, thank you again for joining us. And for everybody listening, we really appreciate you listening to the podcast, and please tell others about it. And we'll have some other episodes on child abuse. I know there's some on sexual abuse and trafficking. So be sure to listen to those as this is National Child Abuse Prevention Month. And we thank you again.